Bring Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and with me as usual is Rich. Hello, Rich.
Hey, what's going on? So I had a whole bit. We were initially going to record this on the day of your birthday, and I had a whole bit about guys, NBA guys that shared your birthday. But now I think it's Kendall Gill, I know, is definitely one of them.
Okay.
There's somebody else, but now I forgot. Are you aware of any NBA players that have your birthday, or no?
No, I'm sure I've looked it up in the past. It does not. I'd have to go in there. I will say that Tracy McGrady was born exactly one day before I was born.
Well, that's something to be proud of. Yeah. Hey, you know what?
May 24th, 1979. I was born May 25th, 1979. All right. So other players born on May 25th. Oh, yeah. I forgot. Casey Jones was born on May 25th. And Bill Sharman, you know, both Celtics guards. So here's the complete list. We got Kendall Gill. We have somebody named Alan Hardy, who played in 1957. Marcelo Huertas. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Alan Hardy was born in 1957. Marcelo Huertas, who was born in 1983. Casey Jones, as mentioned, born in 32. Mark Jones, who played 10 games, was born in 75. Dino Martin.
Hey, I miss the NBA with guys named Dino Martin used to play. Right. That's when the league was the league.
Jason,
ain't no Dino Martins anymore in the league, and that's a shame.
Norm Powell is
Raptors legend Norm Powell.
Bill Sharman, as mentioned, 1926. Paul Thompson and Derek Williams, born in 91. Derek Williams. So this is the Derek Williams,
the Minnesota Timberwolves. Williams. The one that I always thought would be really, really good. He just is not that good. Fine.
Number two overall pick.
I remember being whoa. I remember during the NBA draft watching clips. I'm like, 6'8". Oh, my God. This guy's going to be incredible.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Yes. Dino Martin played for the Providence Steamroll. You know, the
hell yeah.
Yeah, we love some Steamrollers. He played on the team that finished 6-42. So... that was his last year in the league. He was pretty good his first year.
That's not bad.
Old Dino Martin was probably the best player on the
Steamrollers.
The 28-32 Steam. You know, that was a solid team. You know, back when men were men and they were steamrolling through the league.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Not like today. Not when we've got our Norman Powells and our
a bunch Derek of Williams. Flopping. Yeah, Dino Martin was a flop. Are you kidding?
No. Yeah, he was a loyal dinosaur for Fred and for Wilma. You know, he wasn't flopping around exactly.
Apparently, he coached at Boston College for almost a decade as well. So
there
good
you go.
For him. Yeah,
probably better known for that. So, but
he stopped in 1962. So I know you're not up on your 1962 college basketball. So yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, it's a little bit out of my wheelhouse, but I thank you for dig into that. So yeah, we've gone astray as we occasionally do, but since it is not my birthday, but it is time for to return to our topic of a prior show and looking at the longest consecutive seasons of having an under 500 record. So to review for the first episode, we talked about the 2007-21 Sacramento Kings, who have just, of course, accomplished that feat of 15 seasons. And they have tied their own feat of 1984-1998. They started that in Kansas City and ended it in Sacramento. And then the Fort Wayne Detroit Pistons had 14 seasons in a row between 1957 and 1970. And then we closed with the Minnesota Timberwolves from 2006 to 2017, the end of the KG era and into the Kevin Love era, and then finally into the Cat era. So it's sort of been a one season respite for otherwise not so good stuff there in Minnesota. But
yeah, they may have started a whole new era that we could talk about. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. If 12 years maybe. Yeah, yeah, 12 years we'll be talking about them again, perhaps.
Yeah, the way things are going, I don't know.
Not great, yeah.
But it's time to talk some Clippers. We got to get Clippers action going in here. I can't wait.
It's been too long. All right. So the first set of Clippers we'll talk about. There's a couple sets here. 12 seasons between 1980 and 1991. Now, this is a part of a 15-year stretch of playoff-less basketball, which the Kings also just tied the Clippers already. But the Clippers actually did have a winning season in this period early on in which they did not make the playoffs. So as should be obvious here, the number of times they were in the playoffs during this time was zero. Looking at some of the key events during this time. So 1980, they get new free agent signee Bill Walton. And, you know, Bill Walton coming out of, off of injury, but, you know, it seemed like he was, you know, going to be back. Seemed like he was going to be okay. You know, it was new. It was great times in San Diego with the Clippers. He was joining, you know, a team that the prior year, they'd won 43 games, didn't make the playoffs, but only one game or so out of it. You know, they'd World Be Free, who I think had led the league in scoring or was number two in scoring the previous year. They had Sven Nader, they had Brian Taylor, Sidney Wicks. It's toward the end of his career, but, you know, still an okay contributor. So they had some names there. They had some guys who people felt could contribute. But unfortunately, Walton only plays 14 games with a foot injury that season. And then he would miss entirely the next two seasons and only play 169 out of a possible 492 games from 1980 to 1985. So kind of dooming that era of the Clippers there where, you know, they can't get Bill Walton on the floor. And, you know, what's interesting, we'll discuss later, is that you can sort of argue that Walton, despite the limited action, was still the greatest positive contributor to the franchise out of this time, which is just something that's pretty wild.
Yeah, definitely added like an air of respectability to them, which certainly helped. And like you said, anytime he did play, which was very infrequently, he was pretty good. And yeah, it was just like, hey, a player that's okay and used to be good at basketball or is still kind of good at basketball wants to play for our team. And that low bar, but it's the Clippers. So, but hey, you know what? Things are going to get a lot better in 1981 because new ownership is coming in, Jason.
Oh yeah,
write this ship.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Irv Levin isn't cutting it, so he sells to. Let me check this. Donald Sterling.
Oh shit! All right, never mind. Yeah. Never mind. It's gonna suck for another few decades. Crap. All right, never mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Real estate developer and
professional Deutsch. Yeah, professional right. Douchebag.
Yeah, right. Sterling. Yeah. Yeah. $12.5 million. Then the team. You know, 82, they draft Terry Cummings, number two overall, obviously a good pick. But, you know, they have a tendency not to hold on to young Clippers. So we'll see how that goes. September 1982, an NBA committee of owners recommends that Donald Sterling's ownership be terminated, finding that he was late in paying creditors and players.
We could have done it here. It could have been all over.
Could happen, yeah. They did schedule a vote in October of 82 to remove Sterling, but then he agreed to sell the team. The league sought buyers who would keep the franchise in San Diego. The Sterling had already sought to move the team to LA, which the NBA didn't want because they had the Lakers. Like, second team in LA, what's the point of that? So, but by early 83, David Stern, who was then the league vice president, I'm not sure if he was definitely going to become commissioner yet, but he was definitely on track for that. He called the Clippers a first-class franchise, and the ouster of Sterling was no longer pursued. So, yeah,
David, come on.
Right.
If you want to say that we're not going to pursue, you can't call that a, quote, first-class. I mean, there's nothing this time that's first-class about the San Diego Clippers. Come on.
It is not, unfortunately. Yes. And not to get too far off track, but this is, you know, it was around this time, 82, 83, where, you know, it looks like there's, like, six or so teams that are like in financial peril, and the NBA had serious, you know, discussions about contracting the league and, you know, removing, I mean, the Pacers and the Clippers, you know, and the Nuggets and, you know, a couple other teams were, you know, they were really serious about it. And then a few months later, you know, finances started to turn around, and they were able to, you know, kind of, you know, I think obviously the Bird Magic and Jordan effect eventually, you know, led the team to have better revenues and, you know, the things that kind of, you know, the collective bargaining agreement kind of was able to save that. But we were definitely close, probably closer than people realized, to having, you know, some contraction during that time, which obviously would, you know, change the course of NBA history. So, 1983, a couple of big trades. First of all, the Clippers trade away Tom Chambers, who you know, was another of their dynamic young players. A little bit overlap with Terry Cummings, but still, you know, kind of weird.
can't have two good players at the same time.
Right. Yeah.
You got to pay. The problem is you got to pay those players, and that, I mean, that's, you know, I don't really do that.
Right. You know. Now, you know, they get James Donaldson, who was, you know, pretty good big man. They got a couple picks. One of them turned out to be Michael Cage. So, you know, not like the worst trade ever, but definitely like, yeah. You know.
Well, they also traded once he got cut too.
But right.
That's a story for another day. Or later.
And then, yes, they traded Sven Nader and Byron Scott, who they drafted, you know, already that in the 83 draft. He had never played for the Lakers or Clippers, but he was, you know, there up until around the beginning of the season. They the big key is they received a Norm Nixon out of there, and also a second round pick that ended up being Jeff Hornacek. So interesting there, and that actually like Norm Nixon actually played really well for them, but Norm Nixon. dealt with a lot of injuries during that time and was unable to be effective. But when he did play, he actually was really good. It wasn't necessarily like, an awful trade. I mean, Nixon was still relatively young, had been an all-star guard, was, that wasn't, not at all on paper a bad trade, but that ended up being another one of the Clipper blunders during that time.
Yeah, and of course Hornacek would never actually play for them. He'd get bound. Right. His draft pick would get traded a bunch of times.
It went
to the Pistons, and then eventually it went to the 76ers, and they just drafted this guy. Here's this guy. Ended up carving out a great NBA career, or a really, really good NBA career. But we're not going to take that one against the Clippers. That wasn't a sure thing like some of these other guys that they've tried to trade. So.
Yep. So before the 85 season, despite pending lawsuits between the team's ownership and the NBA, the Clippers, they're like, well, we're playing in Los Angeles. So too bad, guys. We're the Los Angeles Clippers now. Deal with it. So they play.
By the way, you're not joking. That's essentially how it went, is they just said, right. no, we play in Los Angeles now. They're like, no, you don't. And they're like, yeah, we do.
We're here.
We're here, and we play basketball here. So this is where we are now.
We're in the Los Angeles Memorial Sports Arena here. I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah.
No, I mean, it wasn't much smoother than that. It was essentially It was San Diego. No, we don't play in San Diego. What are you talking about? We never heard of it. Where is that?
We don't play in San Diego. But Carmen San Diego? No, I don't know. I don't know where she is. But on the eve of the season, in September of 84, they trade Terry Cummings, Craig Hodges, and Ricky Pierce to the Milwaukee Bucks for Junior Bridgman, Harvey Catchings, Marcus Johnson, and Cash. Now, Marcus Johnson, awesome player, still really good. You know, he's older than Terry Cummings, but again, on paper, not necessarily the worst trade. Johnson having being a UCLA guy, having him in LA, that helps local market. I get at least what they're thinking, even though you're getting rid of a younger, probably soon to be better player. But this is around the time in which, the injuries just pile up for them. There's the phenomenon that is called by sports writers the Clipper Triangle, where they just have a terrible set of injuries over the next few seasons. Derek Smith, who was like a rising young star, suffers a knee injury during the 86 season, never the same. Norm Nixon, as we mentioned, has knee injuries. Marcus Johnson has a spinal cord injury, ending his career just a couple years later. Nixon also has an Achilles tendon in the 88 season after he came back and was actually kind of good for a little bit. So just really just the most horrible luck. And then 85 NBA draft, third overall pick. They draft Benoit Benjamin.
Well, that's good, right? I can't imagine that's good. I mean, it's Benoit Benjamin. He's tall. He's good. Like, this is gonna work. Yeah, I think it's gonna work. I don't see any reason why not. So I think Big Ben's gonna come to Los Angeles and really get this franchise on track. I'm sure.
Yeah, Big Ben. That'd have been a good nickname for him. Yeah. we should have thought maybe if he had better marketing, maybe he'd be better remembered. I don't know.
Or if he was good.
Might have helped. Right. Yeah. Well, and we'll get into him a little bit more later about how bad or good he was. But in 85 draft, not the best one ever or anything, but they could have picked Xavier McDaniel. They could have picked Chris Mullin, Detlef Schrempf, Charles Oakley, or if they'd been really clairvoyant, Karl Malone or Joe Dumars. Now, it's hard. Or, honestly, it could have been worse. The fifth overall pick was John Konkak, and the sixth overall pick was Joe Klein. So,
those sound like very Clippers picks, too. So, what? We'll let him slide here on this Benoit Benjamin.
A little bit, and then, the 86-87 season, they hire Elgin Baylor as general manager. And we talked about that in a recent episode on Baylor's passing. Unfortunately, not the best record there, but also didn't have a lot to work with. So we'll give him a little bit of a pass on that. 1988, Danny Manning drafted number one overall in the 88 draft. Hey, no brainer at the time. He was an excellent player, you know, but been awesome in college, led Kansas, you know, with our previous episode, I mentioned our good friend, Larry Brown, you know, in the coaching there at Kansas. And yeah, he stayed at Kansas, of course, forever. And it didn't leave just immediately after that for the NBA. But back to Danny Manning, unfortunately, he injured his ACL in 1989. Never, you know, quite a star player, though. He played a pretty key role on the early 90s team that finally made the playoffs. So, you know, had a good career, but not what you would expect out of that. And the injury certainly did not help. So another aspect of it wasn't just bad management and bad ownership. It was also a lot of bad luck. 1989, they make a good trade. They trade Danny Ferry, who had been, I think, the number two overall pick, didn't want to play there. And they're like, all right, we'll ship you out. We'll bring in Ron Howard, who's actually a good player. And they didn't keep Ron Howard that long. But, hey, they brought him in when he was good. They probably got the best and most productive years out of him. And, you know, kind of formed the basis of the team that, you know, really helped them, you know, finally, you know, have some decent seasons in the early 90s.
Absolutely. Yeah. It ended up being a pretty good trade there. Yeah. It, drafting Danny Ferry when he says, hey, I really don't want to play for you guys, like, don't pick me, and they pick him anyway. That could have been even more disastrous than it was, but it ended up working out okay for them and getting someone like a Ron Harper and even a first round pick, you know, a few years down the line that ended up being Loy Vaught, who, you know, not a tremendous player at all, but Loy Vaught ended up becoming a pretty good player for the Clippers as well. So they got a lot of value out of a guy with, you know, they almost had zero leverage in this case, where Danny Ferry was just like, look, I'll play in Italy, I'm not gonna play for you. Like,
right.
You can keep me all you want. I'm never coming to play for this team because you guys are terrible and I don't want to play for you. So, you know, Given that amount of leverage, the idea that they were able to get, you know, Ron Harper, a first round pick and a first round pick for Danny Ferry, that not bad at all. So,
yeah. I wonder why Danny Ferry didn't like the Clippers. I mean, it couldn't have been the racism.
Yeah, oh, no. Right? I was going to say this. He didn't know. He was like, they're a bad team. They're racist. He's like, oh, hold on.
Oh, like, okay.
Hey. I'm interested. Hey. Keep talking. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I like that. So anyway, best player of this era for the Clippers. Well, you know, we've already talked about, hey, the Clippers actually had quite a few talented players during this era, but none of them really lasted for very long. We just for reasons discussed above. So, if you're looking at the value over replacement stat from the Clippers of this era, you actually, the number one on here is Benoit Benjamin. And he has a 5.8 value over replacement. Now, you know, may not have a lot of context for value over replacement. So, you know, Benjamin's on the team, you know, we're counting him from 86 to 91. So, you know, 5-6 seasons. Looking at Magic Johnson's value over replacement for the same time period, 42.3. So, you know, you're talking about one of the best players in the league. That's the value you get from them. Benoit Benjamin, you get, you know, about 6. So, hey, it may not be fair to compare Benoit Benjamin to Magic Johnson, but we just did it and there's nothing you can do about it. So I'd be sad. You look at the number two player on this list, Bill Walton, 5.3 value of replacement, not that far, but he played in only 169 games where Walton played in 406. Now, again, the fact that you could even make a minor statistical case that broken down, barely can stay on the floor, Bill Walton was the best Clipper of this era says a whole lot here. You know, his numbers, you know, for the time, you know, 12 points per game on 55 true shooting, 9 rebounds, 3 assists per game. You know, solid numbers, nothing spectacular, but, you know, solid numbers, all things considered. But again, the availability was the issue for him. So probably most sensible choice here. Cherry Cummings, you know, only played 2 seasons here, but, you know, averaged 23.3 points per game, 10.1 rebounds per game, 151 games, and he's third on this list of the value replacement players. So I would say, given a lack of other good choices for, you know, this time, I'm saying that we're going to go with Cherry Cummings.
I think that's fair. Yeah, it's so pathetic that Bill Walton can really make a case for him. But yeah, right. I agree. I think we go with Terry Cummings there. And that's it sucks because, like you said, there are a lot of decent players there. There's a lot of guys that are like, hey, that guy's an okay player. But it's like, yeah, they're only there for 2 years or 3 years or something like that, or a year. Or they're barely, you know, so.
Sure.
But yeah, I think Terry Cummings is a great pick here.
Yeah. So coaching changes, we start with Gene Shue. Then we get Paul Silas just after he retired as a player. We got Jin Lynham. We got Don Chaney, who was a midseason replacement. Then we got Gene Shue coming in number two, twice that Gene Shue gets to enjoy this era. Then we get Don Casey, and then we get Mike Schuler, who would eventually get replaced in 1992 when the team finally made the playoffs. So those are the Clippers coaches during that time. Best season out of this era would be probably the 81 season. The right beginning of it, they were 36-46. It was the first year for Paul Silas. He got solid seasons out of Sven Nader and Phil Smith. And Freeman Williams had 19.3 points per game in just 24 minutes per game.
My guy. I love it.
This is 45th all time for points per 36 minutes in a season. This is since 74. That would be 28.9 points per 36 minutes. He's only one of 31 players to reach this threshold, and he's the only one who was never an all-star. So that is your Freeman Williams fact for the day.
There you go. I love it. Get those shots, man. You know what I mean? When you're in there, make the most of your minutes. I love it.
Yeah, exactly. Worst season. Yeah, so a lot of choices here. But the 87 season, they were 12-70 with a negative 11 SRS. It's the third worst winning win-loss percentage in BAA in NBA history. At the time, now we're ranked seventh, so still pretty bad, and the ninth worst ever in SRS. Also, the 88 and 89 Clippers, who had better records, but were among the 22 worst teams ever in SRS. So those three season stretch for the Clippers, probably if you're going to look at any three season stretch in NBA history for worst, that's probably up there in terms of that. Yeah. Right there with. Right there, probably even worse than the process Sixers, you know.
Definitely, definitely there. Yeah, the 90s, you know, Mavericks, that like 92 to 95 right. Mavericks are right up there. But this is legendary bad. I mean, this is just three just absolutely horrendous, nothing happening seasons for the Clippers. And the juxtaposition of the Clippers doing this while across town, you know, the Lakers are the Showtime Lakers, you know, wrapping up, you know, another championship and championship after championship, NBA final berth after NBA final berth with the most popular player in the league and Magic. It's just like, God, just imagine being a Clipper, like a real Clippers fan, I don't know why you would be. I mean, first off, what are you doing? And second off, like, man, that's just got to be just absolutely brutal as you're sitting there, you know, and watching the 1988 Los Angeles Clippers being like, nope, this is LA's team, yep. baby. Like, this team is the one that represents Los Angeles. True and true. So.
Yeah, Billy Crystal out there. Just
right. Like, no. Yeah. This is it.
Yeah, so. this is what I want. I want me some Benoit Benjamin. Give it to me.
Right. Yeah,
more give me Benoit. The Benjamin. I'm all about the Benoit Benjamin.
Yeah. That's incredible. Yes. Well, hey, speaking of the Clippers, we got more Clippers action here. How about that? So, 1994 to 2000. Oh. Yeah.
Yes. Rich, I'm sorry. We've got some breaking news. We got something really important
about the 1994 right Clippers. There. Breaking news right now about the 1994 Clippers. Get out of here. But go ahead.
Not about the 94 Clippers, but it is related to Clippers because Manscaped.com. We've got something that we got a PSA brought to us by Manscaped.com. It's the news that we've all been waiting for. The Manscaped engineering team has confirmed that they have successfully created. Get this. The Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer.
Nice. Nice job.
Now available for purchase. And, you know, we were one of the first to get our hands on it and to share the news. Just incredible stuff.
Yes, the advanced ceramic blade, skin-safe technology. It's so good that it almost seems as if Manscaped worked with Elon Musk's engineers to ensure that your testes are as safe as possible. So what makes this trimmer different than all other trimmers? Well, let me tell you right now, a new multifunction on and off switch can engage a travel lock, which is created for people who like to travel. So that's good if you don't want it to start buzzing in your luggage. You have the travel lock that you can do there. You also, the Lawnmower 4.0 also gives you the ability to turn the 4000K LED spotlight on or off when needed for a more precise shave. The new trimmer even allows you to customize your trim all over through additional guard lengths of sizes 1 to 4. So if you just want to trim up a little bit, you can do it. If you want to trim it all off, you can do that. And looks-wise, it's sleek with a two-tone matte and gloss finish that even features a hot foil-stamped black chrome Manscaped logo. You can show off that mower loud and proud.
Yeah, and the optimized Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer It's waterproof. You can groom the shower. You don't have to worry about making a mess in the bathroom floor. It's always problematic for me. It definitely great if you could do it in the shower. And also, hey, wireless charging. The new wireless charging system, the Lawnmower 4.0, it uses electromagnetic induction, which can help your battery length last longer. And, you know, absolutely, you know, if it's going to be buzzing in your suitcase and you need that battery length to last longer, luckily, definitely. You know, with the lock, that's not going to be a problem. But, you know, if you make a mistake, you don't turn on the lock, your battery is still going to be good. So great stuff. And, you know, honestly, if you're still trimming your face with your ball trimmer, time to make some changes.
Yeah, what are you doing?
Really need to go with Manscaped, you know?
Yeah, what are you doing here? But thankfully, yeah. You can get 20% off plus free shipping right now with code FANSIDED20 at manscaped.com. Again, 20% off and free shipping with the code FANSIDED20 at manscaped.com. Once again, 20% off plus free shipping. Use that code FANSIDED20, unlock your confidence, and always use the right tools for the job with Manscaped.
Yeah. All right. Now I think
about some other clippers that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Clippers that will make you sad and make things hurt and bleed. It's the Los Angeles Clippers. They're back. Yes. Hey. They're back. Another 12 years, 1994 to 2005. So one time they made the playoffs in this era, 1997. So congratulations to the Los Angeles Clippers for
36-46.
The Western Conference guys, not always good. It's been good for the last 20 years, but there was a time when it was bad too. So. And sometimes the Clippers would luck in and make the playoffs during this period. So major franchise events that happened, kind of during this era. Of course, one that we have talked about many, many times, trading Danny Manning for Dominique Wilkins, a trade that I think on a previous episode, a few episodes ago, we justified this trade for both teams and said it was actually not, to an extent. We played a little devil's advocate. Right. I mean, I wouldn't do it, but it was, we justified the reasons why you might want to do it, but we probably said that, hey, you probably shouldn't have done it anyway. But hey, you know what?
Sure.
The Clippers wanted them some Dominique Wilkins, and they got some Dominique Wilkins. But
hey, 3 months Dominique Wilkins is better than none at all.
Exactly right. So what they also tried to do during this era that did not work out, they tried to move to Anaheim. So it's a constant thing with Donald Sterling is looking for, what else, what he can do in the next payday coming up. So
him and Larry Brown, they just love to move on. Yeah.
they love the next thing. So 1994 to 1999, they played several games at the Arrowhead Pine of Anaheim, also the home of WrestleMania 12. And WrestleMania 2000, I believe, as well. So
yeah.
There you go.
Some of our favorite WrestleManias.
Yeah, absolutely. Two of the best WrestleManias ever, of course.
Yeah, I mean, four McMahons and four corners. What can go wrong?
Could possibly go wrong? Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Clippers games did actually draw a much higher average attendance per game at the Arrowhead Pond than they did at their home games at the Los Angeles Sports Arena, which makes sense because if you're in Los Angeles, why the hell would you go to a Clippers game? So
right. Yeah.
I get it. It makes sense. So they do that from 1994 to 1997. They draw an average of 16,000 fans per game at the Arrowhead Pond, while when they're in Los Angeles, they get around 9,200 per home game. So Anaheim officials and the Clippers have ongoing talks about moving to Anaheim full-time before that pond is even built as well. So this is the conversation that happens even before this. And then Donald Sterling, of course, at this time was pursuing options to play elsewhere in the L.A. area while the, he was looking for a replacement for the sports arena, saying, hey, we can't keep playing here. This arena's old and bad. And, my team is great, but this arena's old and bad, and you need to figure this out.
Yeah. Right. I mean, after the stink of WrestleMania 7, I can't play my team here anymore. After enduring Sergeant Slaughter versus Hulk Hogan, I can't do it anymore.
I'm done. We gotta leave this place. This place is permanently scarred forever. So,
Exactly. Yeah.
Anyway, in 1997, they almost make it happen. They nearly moved to Anaheim permanently. According to a Los Angeles Times article from June of 1996, owner Donald Sterling turned down a deal that would have paid the team $95 million over 12 years. So they actually try to make it happen, but for whatever reason, which is probably leverage for a new building in Los Angeles, Donald Sterling decides, nah, I don't really want $95 million over 12 years. So essentially then they do even more stuff here. The Ogden Corporation, who at the time managed the pond, and the city of Anaheim offered the Clippers a multi-tier deal that would have included upwards of $33 million paid to the team over the first 6 years of their agreement. And then obviously a bunch of other stuff as well. Ogden and Sterling were in talks to have the management company take care of the Clippers' day-to-day operations as well. So they would have really been weirdly kind of like owned by the stadium. That it's very strange stuff. Anyway, but what's going on at the time is the Walt Disney Corporation, who owns the Anaheim Ducks and the Anaheim Angels, also were trying to get involved in the mix too, and you know, get some partial ownership of the Clippers. And you know, also a thing that if I was Donald Sterling, I would have definitely got involved with, given where things would go. They were also trying to do a regional sports network as well in Southern California that would have been a collection of the Anaheim Ducks, the Anaheim Angels, and the, you know, Anaheim Clippers, or whatever you're going to call the Clippers that moved there. But that never happens. ESPN West never comes to fruition. That never happens. And then the Staples Center is built. And Donald Stern decides, you know what? Yeah, actually, I'm fine with LA. LA's fine. So he then becomes tenants with the Lakers and the Los Angeles Kings in the brand new Staples Center. So was it a real flirtation or just leverage? I'll let you decide. But
Anaheim's always the bridesmaid, never the bride. Yeah, the Kings did the same thing. Apparently, it's part of having a terrible stretch of basketballs, you have to flirt with Anaheim, you know, in order to really to cement the deal. So yes, good times. Yeah. And you know, things weren't really necessarily a whole lot better on the court. And you know, the drafting decisions, you know, we talked about earlier on, it's a lot of bad luck, some bad decisions, but you know, one decision that was definitely not great is drafting Michael Olakande at number one overall in the 1998 draft. Did not work out particularly well.
No, and it's not a great draft, but yeah, the Candyman at number one definitely did not work. And they tried a lot of things to get the Candyman to work. They even hired Kareem Abdul-Jabbar as a coach, which I guess through osmosis, they're like, "Hey, Kareem, just tell him what to do." And he's just like, I don't know what to do. I don't know. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, what am I teach this kid? Like, I don't know. Be better.
Yeah, I was good.
Why do what I do. Good? Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I was really good. Just try doing that. Like, you know, it did not work. Started. Kareem did not last there. He said, "This guy sucks. I'm done." And left. So, eventually, though, after a few years of hopelessness, they do finally draft some fun and good players as well. A combination of fun and good, which is very rare in Clippers land. Lamar Odom, Darius Miles, Quentin Richardson. They make a huge deal here too, where they, you know, they draft Tyson Chandler and then trade him to the Chicago Bulls for Elton Brand, which is actually a pretty interesting thing well, because Elton Brand brought a lot of stability to that team, really got things together, and arguably I'd say he's the best player of this era of Clippers basketball. I mean, his win share is a 41.4. Far exceed anybody else. I mean, the honorable mentions, Corey Maggette at 28.9, Eric Piakowski at 27.6. I mean, that is not good. Eric Piakowski is one of your top four, one of the top three players for win shares over a course of 12 years. And then the aforementioned Lloyd Vaught also 23.5 during this era as well. So it's pretty much unquestionably Elton Brand. That makes this team, you know, pretty good. And you know, we end this, you know, segment at 2005, and that's really because Elton Brand has like a career year in 2005, and the team's like actually good and actually makes like an okay playoff run. Like, we're not going to talk about that here, but yeah, it, like, there was a period where it was like, hey, wait, the Clippers may have figured this out. And obviously things would kind of go awry until, you know, the Chris Paul, Blake Griffin era. But yeah, this is the first time of real, the end of this era is the first time of real kind of enjoyment and hope for the Clippers in many, many, many years. Coaching changes, many along the way: Bob Weiss, Bill Fitch, Chris Ford, Jim Todd, Alvin Gentry, Dennis Johnson, and then finally Jason's favorite coach of all time, Mike Dunleavy.
My favorite, I love myself some Mike Dunleavy, and I really love myself some Mike Dunleavy Jr.
It's neck and neck. Yeah, your favorite player and your favorite coach, and yeah, when the two combined at certain points, it was just it was too much for you. So
the Clippers have not had a losing season since 2011.
Wow.
Yeah, they have had a winning season. They've been over.
Yeah,
six,
I guess it makes sense. But damn, all right.
Yeah, they've had a winning percentage of better than 585, so 48 wins outside of one season. The 2018, they were 42-40. So yeah, I mean, they've been remarkably good. I mean, obviously they haven't had the playoff success, but you know, they've really been a remarkably good franchise over the past decade. You know, kind of quietly. It's like you think about it, like every year, like, yeah, they've had good players and yeah, they've had a good success, but yeah, sustained success. They haven't had the major dips that you kind of would expect during that time. So yeah, anyway,
Got things on track there, but
sure.
So the best season of this era, probably 2002. So as we said, they make the playoffs in 1997, but they do so with a 36-46 record. But I really do think the best season is this 2002 season, because this is when it feels. It's like a feel thing at the time where they actually finally seem like they had righted the ship a little bit. They finished the year 39-43. They just barely missed the playoffs as well. This is the year that they trade second overall pick Tyson Chandler for Elton Brand. The Bulls want to get younger and more dynamic, and the Clippers say, hey, there's a guy that's pretty good and averaging 20 points a game and can bring some stability to this team. And he absolutely does. I mean, it would be a lot of fun to see Tyson Chandler with these other guys, but it definitely works a lot better with Elton Brand here because he joins the core of Lamar Odom, who was kind of the do-everything, exactly like you know Lamar Odom was. He was a do-everything kind of guy, just a crazy, like, sort of the original unicorn of this era who could, you know, play point guard and center and do pretty much everything on the court. Quentin Richardson, who was a great shooter. Corey Maggette, a good defender, kind of a burly guy, could get down and get fouled. Then Darius Miles, who was just awesome and had a headband, so it was pretty cool. So
yeah, things go lots of headbands there.
Yeah, that's so good. It goes. Yeah. A lot of touching the headbands. Like they were a cool for the first time ever. They were cool. Like they were on covers of Slam. It was like, hey, the Clippers are kind of cool actually. So
yeah, they were your hipster team. You know?
Yeah.
But they had a point there where it looked like they were going to be, kind of that new wave of the NBA of, you know, all these swingmen and all these, all these lengthy guys and just everybody being able to do everything and exciting stuff. And various things happened. You know, Odom, ended up, not doing well there and heading out and, like you alluded to, Maggette stuck around. And of course, Brand kind of was the centerpiece there and they put together some, decent teams. I hate to give Mike Dunleavy too much credit, but and he was a good coach there for quite a while as well. So but back to 2002.
Yeah, so the team is they're 36 and 33 at one point in mid-March. They lose seven of their final 10 games and finish below 500 and out of the playoffs. The Utah gets the eighth seed with a 44-38 record. Brand, though, selected to the 2002 All-Star Game, your first Clippers All-Star since Danny Manning was selected in 1994. So things are starting to look up for the Clippers. Well, not really. So they have many, many bad years, and then they'd have a good year, and then they'd have some bad years, and then they would have this run that we're talking about now. So, hey.
Sure.
Ends up working out pretty well. So the worst season during this era, unquestionably, the 1999 season. The year starts off with hope as the Clippers get the number one overall pick, and they decide to draft Michael Olowokandi. And believe it or not, the idea is that, like, Michael Olowokandi got in the league and immediately was just like, oh, God, this guy's terrible and can't do anything. His NBA debut isn't bad. He scores 14 points, has three straight double-doubles as well, or three straight double-digit scoring games, I should say. The problem was he had a lot of fouls. He was fouling out of pretty much every game that he was in, and eventually that guy doesn't catch up with you. But overall, I mean, he finished the year 8.9 points per game and 7.9 rebounds per game. So he's not bad. I mean, for a rookie, a guy that had only started playing basketball like 3 years prior or whatever it was, I mean, that's not that bad. Like, it's okay. Right. The problem is he doesn't really improve all that much. He doesn't get much better over the years. He starts to kind of lose interest in the game. The mounting expectations kind of doom him. But, I don't know. Like, the question of it was it a bad pick at the time? Like, it's easy to say that now, but there's some, I found some quotes here. Stu Jackson, who was the Grizzlies executive at this time, which I guess, it's
not good.
I mean, it's the Grizzlies. Not like, well, why would have taken him? It's like, well, your team won like 12 games. Like, I don't know. Right. The guys we should be asking, about what to do. But anyway, that's a veteran NBA guy says. But anyway, he says, quote, they have to take him. You understand that in this league where size is at a premium, you have someone of that size and his athletic ability and you're in need of a center. They have to take him. I think they finally realized that. And the Baltimore Sun had an article about this as well. It says, size matters. Unable to resist the potential of a man who made tremendous strides in his 3 years of organized basketball, the Clippers selected Olowokandi. Size mattered to the Denver Nuggets, who pulled off a minor surprise of the third pick with 6'11 Rafe LaFrance from Kansas. And size mattered to the Milwaukee Bucks, who used the ninth pick to select 6'11 Dirk Nowitzki from Germany. So for the Clippers, the uncertainty a free agent, Isaac Austin, probably had a lot to do with the selection. I love that quote that they're like, oh, man, I guess Isaac's going to leave in free agency. Guys, we need to replace Isaac Austin. So what do we do? We can't just leave this void that Isaac Austin, this tremendous void Isaac Austin is going to leave for this team. But anyway, hope was quickly dashed for the Clippers season here after the solid starts from Michael Olowokandi. They lose 17 straight games during the season. They tied the 1989 Miami Heat for the worst start in NBA history. 17 straight games to start the season. Unbelievable. The team would lose 30 of their first 33 games, as well as the final six games of the season. Their only saving grace, really, was that it was a lockout shortened year. They didn't play all 82 games. They finished 9-41. Only the Grizzlies, the Stu Jackson's Grizzlies, had a worse record, 8-42. So,
yeah, right.
This is not good. Maurice Taylor leads the team in scoring with 16.8 points per game. That is not good. Your leading scorer. It was the era where nobody could score and everybody was terrible.
It was slowed down. Yeah, it was like one of the slowest pace seasons of all time.
Yeah, so that's not good. Everybody was kind of fat. Yeah. Nobody was really trying, but still 16.8 points per game is
right. Yeah, that was a tough schedule. Yeah.
Maurice Taylor leading your team in scoring is probably not a good sign.
Yeah, maybe I don't know. Yeah, maybe they should have picked Vince Carter or Paul Pierce.
Anton Jameson, yeah. Paul Pierce.
Yeah, or Dirk Nowitzki. That would have been a stretch.
No, dude. The Grizzlies knew it. Yeah, I'm trying to think. The Vancouver Grizzlies, who are their draft? Well, is that the year they drafted Steve Bibby. Francis? Or no?
No, they picked Mike Bibby.
Okay. Size matters. Oh, yeah. There's this point guard.
Right. And then, did they trade Bibby? They traded Bibby for what happened there? Did Bibby ever play for the Grizzlies, or did he get?
Oh yeah, he did. They traded him for Jason Williams eventually, a few years later. So
that's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, good call. Yes. So So we got another happy dozen here with the Golden State Warriors of a similar time frame, 1995 to 2006. They did not make the playoffs at all during that stretch. Looking at some of the major events, October 1994, just predating this, Chris Kohan becomes the new Golden State Warriors owner. And I know that there are any Warriors fans listening to this just got a shudder up
just
their spine.
Vomited.
When they heard the name Chris Kohan. November 1994, they just had, the guy who was the rookie of the year, who they picked number one overall, he's going to be the centerpiece of our the next era of franchise. Everything's going to be going good. They traded him to the Washington Bullets for Tom Gugliotta and three future first-round picks that became Todd Fuller in 1996, Vince Carter in 1998, and 2000, Chris Mim in 2000. So, yeah, one of those worked out. None of them for the Bullets, unfortunately, but or for the Warriors rather, but one of those did work out. Heading into the 95 season, were looking pretty good for the Warriors. They'd won 50 games the previous year, as we said, with, Chris Webber being rookie of the year. They had Latrell Sprewell in his second year, who was NBA all first team. They had Chris Mullin still, who was, a little aging, but still a, really good player. And then, they had Tim Hardaway coming back, from an ACL issue. Injury. So there was a little bit of a question, but they had plenty of talent there. However, there had been tensions between Coach Don Nelson and Chris Webber. He exercised an out clause in his contract after just 1 year. This was right before NBA went to very standard rookie contracts with standard salary scale and all that good stuff, which prevented that from happening in the future. They didn't really have any leverage. So they were like, all right, we're going to trade Chris Webber for Tom Gugliotta and some draft picks and see how that goes. And did not go great.
No, that definitely. Yeah. It's a weird era when you read about this stuff and you're like, hey, what the hell? But yeah, this is before the lockouts, the 1990 lockout, where they would kind of get that thing together and they would have just, every rookie got pretty much the exact same contract or, depending on where you're drafted, things went up. But yeah, this time it was a wild, wild west. I mean, guys got signed for crazy big deals and they had opt-out clause and all this sort of, it's pretty wild. I kind of miss these days because it made for some pretty interesting, very strange, early, Juwan Howard, obviously, was very strange as well. I mean, Chris Webber and Juwan Howard, probably two of the more famous guys that just had, very weird contracts initially as rookies. But, things got regular. It got back on track pretty quickly here for the NBA. But, does not go very well for the Chris Webber, Don Nelson era in Warrior Land.
Yes, yeah. So, and then, February 95, Don Nelson, who's been the coach there since, I think, 89, he resigns. He's out of there. Just a few days later, they trade Tom Gugliotta to the Timberwolves for Danielle Marshall. So they keep getting worse players out of
they turned Chris Webber to Danielle Marshall. Yeah, that's right. Not great.
Yeah, not great. No. 95, they have the first round in the draft again. They pick Joe Smith.
Size matters, baby.
Yeah. So Joe Smith, solid NBA player, but obviously never lived up to that contract. 96 and 97, they eventually trade away Tim Hardaway to the Miami Heat. They get Bimbo Coles and Kevin Willis. They trade Chris Mullin to the Pacers for Eric Dampier and Dwayne Farrell. You notice that they keep trading better players for worse players.
Yeah, they should really try to get a good player in a trade. That might help this franchise.
Might be good, yeah. 97.
While you trade Tim Hardaway and get Bimbo Coles? What are you doing? what are you doing?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, you know, granted, you know, Tim Hardaway, you know, these guys were older. They weren't, you know, they weren't getting fetched like the greatest returns ever, but it seemed like they may be could have done a little bit better here. But anyway, 97, they play in the San Jose Arena while the Oakland Coliseum is being renovated. So they're not flirting with Anaheim, but they spend some time in San Jose, which, you know, I think is the other market that gets, you know, that's always like leveraged against whenever a team wants a new arena. 98 draft, they draft Vince Carter with the 5th pick overall in the first round, and they trade him and cash to the Toronto Raptors for Anton Jameson. So, yeah, they pick a better player and then trade for a worse one. You know, still a good one, but you definitely, you know, looking back on it, you would much rather have Vince Carter's career than Anton Jameson's career, I would say.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah. But that's a decent enough trade. I mean, that's a good.
Yeah. Kinda, I mean, it's not terrible. I mean, yeah, Anton Jameson, it's not a huge mistake, but it's, you know.
In terms of like marketing and dynamics and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. You probably rather have Vince Carter, but, you know, Jameson's solid enough player.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to disparage the good name of Anton Jameson, but, you know, Vince Carter is likely a Hall of Famer and Anton Jameson is not quite a Hall of Famer, you know. So, but yeah, really good player, really solid career.
And then would end up, you know, showing them in the 2000 All-Star Game and dunk contest, like, I was a member of your team, and now I'm going to become the most popular player in the league because I do cool dunks. And it's like,
there you go.
We have the stupid Lightning mascot guy, so yeah, that's what we got going for us. So.
Yeah, that's great, yeah.
He had a dumb name, too. I forget what it is. I don't think.
It was Thunder, I think.
Was it Thunder? Yeah. Oh, okay.
His name was Thunder, yeah. Before the team was the Thunder, but 1998 season. We've gone over this in depth, so I'll just mention it briefly. But we have the Latrell Spiro choking incident of Pedro Carlissimo. It creates a moral panic throughout the world, and everyone hates the NBA because of it. I'm stretching it, of course, but there is a lot of outrage about the NBA and about, you know, thug players and not respecting coaches and blah blah blah. Yeah, I don't know what sort of, you know, that feeling, you know, emotion that people have about each other could be contributing to, you know, these feelings. You know, it's hard to put it into words. Racism, excuse me. Yeah. Anyway, that ends with after the lockout, the Warriors end up trading the Latrell Sprewell to the Knicks for Terry Cummings, who's very old by this time, Chris Mills, and
John Cummings now. What are you doing?
And John Starks. Again, the trading for worse players, you know, trading your good players for worse ones. They did not have much choice in the situation, but
you leverage a little low when you're trying to trade a player that just choked your coach. Leverage is tough. Yeah.
Yeah. So, 2001 draft, they have a good one. They draft Jason Richardson in 5th overall in the first round. Speaking of, you know, exciting dunkers, they get Jason Richardson. They are not bad. They get Troy Murphy, you know, who was the 14th pick overall in the first round. You know, solid player, pretty good, you know, value for that pick. He was a good rebounder, could shoot some threes, you know, for a big man. And then they drafted Gilbert Arenas in the second round, the 31st pick of that draft. So yeah, they get three contributors, two really good contributors there. 2001, also Anton Jameson scores 51 points at back-to-back games. So take that, Vince Carter. You've never done that. Yeah. 2002, 2003, not many highlights on the court. Jason Richardson wins back-to-back slam dunk contest.
Yeah, put some respect on those. Yeah, go back and watch those. Jason Richardson's awesome in those dunk
contests. Great stuff. Oh, yeah. He was great. Yeah, probably a little underrated.
Absolutely. Absolutely underrated.
Great dunkers. Yeah, probably. I would put him in the top 10, probably, you know. I think he's definitely, you know, he was, yeah, they didn't quite have the star power, so not quite as recognized, but yeah, definitely some great stuff there. 2003, unfortunately, because they had committed so much money to Danny Fortson, Adonna Foyle, and Eric Dampier, the Warriors were unable to re-sign Gilbert Arenas. So he ends up having to go to the Wizards. Anton Jameson ends up going to the Wizards as well, as well as Larry Hughes, who had previously played. He played briefly for the Warriors, if I'm not mistaken, as well. Yeah. So, yeah, which is kind of funny there. And they make a massive trade to the Dallas Mavericks, getting rid of Anton Jameson, and just mostly for salary cap reasons. But the full trade is Danny Fortson, Anton Jameson, Chris Mills, and Jerry Welsh to the Mavericks for Evan Eschmeyer, Avery Johnson, Popeye Jones, Antoine Rigaudeau, and Nick Van Exel. Again, they are not getting back the best player in this trade.
They are not. No, they
keep,
no,
they keep doing that. Yes,
they do that a lot. Yeah, and this is a trade that because I was a big Mavericks fan at this time, you know, growing up, and still pretty fun to follow the Mavericks. And this is sure. the year that they decided, you know what, defense is stupid. Like, let's just have Dirk, Steve Nash, Anton Jameson, and Antoine Walker, and everything is going to go okay. And I was all in, and it did not work out very well. But
well, you know. Hey, they scored a lot of points.
They scored a hell of a lot of points that year, but they read the ship pretty quickly. This is the during a fun era of Dallas Mavericks where pretty much every single year they would trade like half their players that weren't Dirk and Nash and try to make it work or whatever. So
and of course the Mavericks, coached by Don Nelson, that's where he went after Golden State. So there's that part piece of it as well. 2004, hey, Gary St. John, who's been the GM for all this, maybe you're not that great at your job. Let's go ahead and get Chris Mullin in here. He's succeeding him as the executive VP of basketball operations. One of the first major deals he makes, February 2005, they trade Speedy Claxton and Dale Davis to the Hornets for Baron Davis.
They did it. They got a good player.
Get the better player in the trade. Hey. It works out.
That's a hell of a deal, man. What the hell's New Orleans doing here? Speedy Claxton and Dale Davis for Baron? Yeah. What are you guys doing?
I think Baron had some injuries and there was some disgruntledness going on there. So I think that was feeding into part of this. But yes, that certainly on paper.
New Orleans Hornets not exactly the most profitable organization at this time.
Or well run.
More importantly, or well run. Yeah,
not a strong ownership there. Yeah. Yes, and then in the offseason 2006, Golden State, they hire former coach Don Nelson, who Avery Johnson, a former Warrior Avery Johnson, part of the Anton Jameson trade. He coaches the Mavericks, so Nelson goes back to Golden State, and they've got some of the key pieces, of course, Baron Davis. They would make the big trade. Trading away Mike Dunleavy and Troy Murphy for Steven Jackson and Anton Jameson Steven Jackson and Al Harrington.
Yep.
And that, of course, leading to the We Believe Warriors and at least a few good times. Another one where it was fleeting, and then eventually they transitioned into a great era with somebody named let me check this. Steph Curry.
Yeah, some little guy at Davidson. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
He's gonna shoot threes. He's gonna win games by shooting threes. Okay. Good luck, pal.
Yep. So coaching changes. They had Don Nelson. Then they get Bob Lanier as an interim coach. They get Rick Adelman. You always forget a little bit the couple years of Rick Adelman with the Warriors, just kind of between Portland and Sacramento. PJ Colosimo, we talked about that already. Gary St. John, interim coach. Dave Cowens, not a good fit for the Warriors. Not a team that wanted to play much defense. And Dave Cowens kind of all about effort and defense. Brian Winters, another 70s guy, 80s guy player who's coaching there. Interim coach Eric Musselman and Mike Montgomery. They tried the college coach route a little bit, and that does not go particularly well.
No, it does not.
Now, they did actually have, they kind of had some decent seasons here in the early, those last few seasons before the We Believe year. I mean, they won 38, 37, 34, and 34 games. So they weren't like absolutely terrible for, all this time. Now they did win between like 19 and 21 games from 98 to 02. So those years were really bad. Then they get more just kind of middling, mediocre. They still have Jason Richardson and some good players. So they're never going to be that bad. But the best season, 38 and 44 in 2003, they had Jameson, Gilbert Arenas, and Jason Richardson all as an exciting young core. And they would lose two of those guys. But, eventually, as we said, they would find some guys to replace them. Worst season, 17 and 65 in the 2001 season. Chris Mullin making a on-court return to the Warriors in 2001. It's like, oh, man, I came back for this. This is not ideal. That was definitely their worst team on the court.
Yeah.
But probably the real answer is 1998. Anytime, your star chokes out the coach, creates a national Moral Panic, you know, that's probably the better choice. They were 19-63 that year as well. So basically as bad on the court. And yes, they absolutely have.
Yeah, the basketball court and the public court was not good. Of you being the representative of all the ills of today's sports right. society is, yeah, it's right. pretty bad. Anyway, well, speaking of horrible franchises, hey, these guys only lost 10 years in a row, so it's not too bad here. Your Dallas Mavericks, 1991 to the year 2000.
My Dallas Mavericks. I'm sorry, sir. These are your Dallas Mavericks.
Dallas Mavericks. Yes. This is not what I like the Mavericks. This is what I just laughed at. I played NBA Jam, and I was like, who would ever pick the Mavericks? Not me.
Right.
So,
and
I never did. I still don't know if I've ever picked the Mavericks in NBA Jam. But anyway, 1991 to 2000. Number of times in the playoffs, zero. So major franchise events. The thing, though, with these Mavericks are they were in usually stable franchise through all of the 80s. And we've talked about this team a lot during the 80s. I mean, this was a really, really cool franchise that was really good. They just never could, like several other teams, couldn't quite get over the hump, could never really quite make a deep, deep run into the NBA Finals or out of the Western Conference, mostly because the Lakers are there. And you know, they stumble into the Trailblazers and a bunch of other teams, you know, the Rockets at certain times as well. But, like, they were a very stable franchise, usually pretty good. Everything was pretty much, you know, business as usual. And then things go to complete disarray here in the 90s. It starts out with Roy Tarpley, one of their young, promising players. He gets banned from the NBA to do drugs. Brad Davis, who was a stable player throughout the 80s, is forced to retire. Fat Lever, who they had acquired from the Nuggets, he has knee surgery. They trade a bunch of first-round picks for him, and immediately he has knee surgery. So it's like they get nothing out of that trade. And then finally, in 1993, the last vestige of that old era is over when they trade Rolando Blackman. So he's sent out of town, and essentially that era is over. Like that team is over.
Derek Carr-Perreault done for a little bit longer. But
the last. Like, I mean, he's on his real last legs at this time.
Absolutely.
Well, Blackman could still play a slight bit, but yeah, they'd both pretty much be done in the next few years. But what's interesting though is the team does acquire a lot of new talent quickly. They get Jim Jackson, Jamal Mashburn, Jason Kidd, and others. Does not translate to wins, though, because in 1993, and we'll talk a little bit more about that year in particular, they become one of the worst NBA teams ever. So, yeah, team is actually okay for a bit during the 1995 season when they finally felt like a team of the future. And then, unfortunately, everybody hates each other. Every one of those guys that I mentioned cannot stand one another. So
Tony Braxton might have been involved.
Yeah, there's some rumors of possibly a love triangle or a love quad or something like that. So that doesn't work out very well. Yeah, Tony Braxton's involved. Everybody hates each other. Jim Jackson doesn't like anybody. Jamal Mashburn doesn't like anybody. Jason Kidd's kind of an annoying little shit at this time. And, well, he continued to be that for most of his career. So that's that. So then in 1997, that entire core is blown up. And 1997 is an insane year. 27 different players stood up for the Mavericks. And this is not a bubble year where you're allowed to have 19 guys in your roster or whatever. Yeah. I mean, this is ridiculous that 27 people would suit up for a team in 1 year. And here's the greatest representation of this 1997 season. By the time the season is over, one player is retained from their opening night roster. Samaki Walker, which is not great.
You got to stick with Samaki Walker, absolutely.
Yeah, that's not great. So anyway, what does happen, though, is the Jason Kidd trade, they send him to the Phoenix Suns, and that gives them Michael Finley, which is great because they kind of help things out, you know, kind of stabilizes things for a bit. And probably the biggest move as well in this early franchise, or this early, you know, 90s or mid-90s, I should say, is Don Nelson, who was in the front office for the team, says, enough of this shit, all right, steps in to coach the team. And things start going down the right path almost immediately with him. They, you know, in 1998, as we mentioned before, they draft a 7-foot German prospect, Dirk Nowitzki. They also acquire Steve Nash from the Phoenix Suns as well in 1998. And then, things finally start going well. And they finally have their first 40-win season as the new team starts to gel. And then bigger, you know, maybe the biggest of all here in January 14, 2000, the group that previously owned the team, which was led by presidential candidate Ross Perot.
No, I don't. It was his son, I believe, actually.
Oh, that's right, Ross Perot Jr. Well, that's fine.
All right, there you go.
Son of presidential candidate Ross Perot sells the team to then season ticket holder and internet entrepreneur Mark Cuban. And Mark Cuban obviously invests heavily in the team, and things go very well. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about the bad teams. So that's 1991 to 2000. So during this time, only 6 coaching changes, which is not too bad.
Sure.
Richie Abuda or Adubato. Adubato. Yeah, Adubato.
I think there's a song, you know, Aduba Abdado. I don't, I'm, you know. We'll have to research that one. We're not a music podcast group, so
no,
I don't feel the need. Yeah, I don't feel the need to justify that.
Gar Hurd, Quinn Buckner, Dick Mata, a very old Dick Mata, Jim Clemens, and finally Don Nelson. The best season, year 2000. 40-42, as he said, first 40-win season they've had in quite a while. Start the year out 9-23, but then things got on track, sort of, some things along the way during Mark Cuban's first ownership year. He decides, you know what, we need Dennis Rodman on this team. And Jason, to put it lightly, it did not work out very well. The Dennis Rodman in the Mavericks era did not work out very well. But thankfully, when they sent him away and they stopped kind of trying to be a sideshow and just said, hey, let's just let good basketball players play under Don Nelson, things go pretty well. Michael Finley makes his first NBA All-Star game. Second-year forward Dirk Nowitzki ups his scoring average to 17.5 points per game. The Mavericks win 9 of their final 10 games, and really, despite missing the playoffs, had clearly set the stage for that next run, and obviously it does play out pretty well. They'll make 12 straight playoffs and an NBA title in the following years, but this is the year that it really kind of all gets on track, and then the year where it does not get off track, the year where it's easily the worst year that they have ever had. 1993, they go 11-71. They start the year 2-27. At one point, they are 4-57. 4-57. It's absolutely unbelievable. They do a 19-game losing streak during the year as well. Very, very close. Very close to setting the all-time record for the worst NBA record ever. Then was the 9-73 mark by the Philadelphia 76ers. Obviously, that has been, win percentage-wise, has been broken. But what really happens here is Jim Jackson, who they draft, he holds out because, like Danny Ferry, I don't really want to go to play for the Mavericks because you guys suck. Yeah. Like, why do I want to play for you guys? So he does a contract holdout, and he eventually ends that holdout, signs with the team, and they end the year on a 7-14 run and end 11-71. So it's the worst, second worst record in NBA history. Definitely on track to be the worst ever until Jim Jackson came to save the day here. But they have the worst average point differential in the history of the NBA, minus 15.2 points per game. So they're not just losing, they're getting destroyed every single time they come out here. And this is also the first year of their blue road uniforms, which I'm not saying,
right?
But they finally retire those in 2001, and so, you know, when they do the whole, you know, a rebranding. But, you know, they replace the green, the familiar Dallas Mavericks green.
Sure,
they replace it here, and I'm not saying, I'm just saying, like, you know,
hey, fashion matters. Yeah, absolutely. I definitely, you know, we'll have to research that. But I feel like
I think they're the worst. Oh, I forgot to mention, I think they're the worst SRS team of all time too, this 1993 Mavericks.
I believe you're
without even correct. It's like not even close. They're like negative 11 or something.
Right.
Like that.
Yeah.
Like no one's anywhere close.
They're certainly up there. Yeah. Okay, who do you think was the best player of the defining player of this era for the
man.
Yeah. I mean, you would think Kidd, although he, you know, he only played, you know, 182 games out of this time. Finley played 270 games.
It's Finley, I want to say, but
yeah, actually, you look at value of replacement. His he had 10.7 versus Kidd at 5.5. So statistically, Finley actually, seemed like he contributed more. Now, granted, he played 270 games, but. But that's I was surprised. I was expecting Kidd to be number one on the list for that. But I think Jackson would really, or Mashburn would really be the only other two. But they,
doesn't last long.
nobody really lasts long for the Mavericks in this era. I mean, the most that anyone played in this era was Derek Harper, 307 games. So it's another thing where, you know, they just don't necessarily keep guys for long enough for anyone to really stand out. But I guess I would say, even though Finley was kind of there at the end and was there when things, he didn't really have the lowest points there. I mean, things started to get better, you know, once, you know, in the late 90s, and then, you know, get good in 2000. So I think he was kind of the guy.
Yeah, I'd say him. Yeah. I'd say other guys like Derek Harper, I think, is at least in the mix.
Sure.
Like you said, he was still hanging around for a little bit. And then, right. Like Jim Jackson's in the mix. I mean,
Mashburn. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Mashburn. I mean, I think Sean Bradley was actually like okay for a few years as well with them, but it is a lot. Again, a lot of talented players. Like Cedric Sabalas plays there for a little bit, like kind of the late career Cedric Sabalas.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a case to be made with Dirk, even though he only plays for like 2 years during this period. But I think it's definitely Michael Finley.
That makes sense.
With that said, I mean, he only plays like 3 or 4 years during this time period that we're talking about as well. So I think it speaks to the instability of this franchise at this time. And again, when you go through 27 players in a single year, like, yeah, no one's really hanging around for too long.
Yeah, for sure. So I just want to, before we go, I just want to also mention the longest under 500 streaks for the other franchises in NBA history. We're not going to go into any depth, but just want to, for the record, we will share them. So the Wizards Bullets franchise had 9 between 1988 and 1996. The Jazz also had 9 seasons between 75 and 83. I should get these years right. 1975 to 1983. 9 seasons for the Jazz. 9 seasons for the Hawks between 2000 and 2008. 9 for the Knicks between 2002 and 2010. 9 for the Cavs between 79 and 87. And then 8 for the Celtics between 94 and 2001. 8 for the Nuggets between 96 and 2003. The exact same 8 seasons for the Grizzlies as well. 1996 to 2003. 7 for the Rockets, their first 7 seasons of the league between 68 and 74, both San Diego and Houston. 7 for the Nets between 86 and 92. 7 for the Bucks between 92 and 98. The same 7 seasons for the Sixers at 92 through 98, which is interesting. 2 separate stretches of 6 seasons for the Bulls, 82 to 87, so some of the Michael Jordan era, and 99 to 2004, the post-Michael Jordan era. 6 for the Suns between 2015 and 2020, of course, broken this year as they are in the playoffs, the number 2 seed. 6 for the Lakers twice between 56 and 61. Of course, they made the finals one of those seasons, so it's a little bit of asterisk there. Of course, the league very different then. And then more recently, 2014 to 2019 before LeBron comes. 6 for the Magic between 2013 and 2018. 6 for the Blazers between 71 and 76, their first 6 seasons. And then 5 for the Charlotte franchise, the Hornets/Bobcats, the 2005 to 2009. They actually tied that this year, 2017 to 2021. The Pacers, 5 separate stretches, 76 to 80, 82 to 86, and 07 to 11. 5 for the Heat for their first 5 seasons between 89 and 93. 5 for the Raptors between 2009 and 2013. 4 for the Sonics and Thunder franchises, the first 4 seasons for the Sonics between 68 and 71, and then 2006-2009, part of that for the Sonics, and then the end of it for the Thunder, of course. 4 for the Spurs between 86 and 89, as we've said, as you talked about many times, the Spurs, you know, one of the more successful franchises in NBA history. I think this is the first stretch of them not making the playoffs 2 seasons in a row. I think you recently shared that on Twitter. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. It is. It's pretty wild that that's the first time in their entire franchise history that they have not done it. So.
And the Pelicans, the New Orleans franchise, of course, you know, they're also known as the Hornets because it's not confusing at all. 3 separate stretches of 3 seasons between 05 and 07, 12 and 14, and 2019 to 2021. Very interesting. Not a successful franchise generally, the Pelicans, but they have never had more than 3 seasons with a stretch of, you know, under 500 ball. They've always managed to pop up there, even if it's just for a season or two, and then fall down again. Now, of course, their history only dates back to 2005. So, you know, they're one of the more, you know, recent franchises additions, but still, that's I thought that was an interesting fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for checking us out. This was a fun as always, Rich, and good stuff here. You can, of course, find us on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcast. Please give us a rating and review. It always helps others find us, helps spread the word about the show. You can check us out on fansided.com. Lots of great NBA content there at the Step Back. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Over and Back NBA. And what's that Manscaped promo code again, Rich?
Oh, Manscaped is Fansided20 for 20% off plus free shipping for Manscaped.com for that Lawnmower 4.0.
Yep, support our sponsor, Manscaped.com. And thanks everyone for listening. We're back again soon.